Coming up, is innovation dead? White supremacists find out they may just be plain supremacists. And we talk to former HubSpotter and Boston Banana Man, Ray Bugayong. It's Tuesday, the best day of the week. This is Steve Tuschenkel, and you're listening to the New England Tech Podcast. Tech Podcast is brought to you by Hammerhead, content management solutions for media organizations and content creators. You love to write, so why do you hate to publish? Visit us at hammerheadcms.com. Music in the show is by Kurt Baker, Lame Drivers, Monkey Mind, The Pharaohs, and The Barracudas. So here's what's foremost on my mind. This week, WordCamp Rhode Island is just a month away. It is coming up September 22nd and 23rd in my home of East Greenwich, Rhode Island, not literally in my home, but in the town where I live, at the New England Institute of Technology. It's been there for several years now. They're a great host. And WordCamp is a two-day event where people convene, hundreds of people descend on the venue to discuss WordPress and to hear talks about WordPress, to learn more about it. If you're unfamiliar with WordPress, I think most people probably are familiar with WordPress, but I know a lot of people aren't, just from evangelizing it, because WordPress is one of my favorite discussions to have with people who may or may not be savvy about technology. WordPress is a content management system. Now, a lot of people don't even know what a content management system is, so I'll just briefly tell you, it's how content gets on a website. Now, WordPress just happens to be the most popular content management system on the internet. It powers 28% of the internet, which is an incredible, incredible number. It's a huge accomplishment for it to have gotten that far in the 14 years that it's existed, and I've been using it for all 14 years. But think about this. If you are even a moderate user of the internet, and if you're listening to this podcast, I'm guessing you probably are, you use WordPress every day. You just don't know it. You're on a WordPress site, but it's what's on the back end. You're not seeing the WordPress. But WordPress is a free piece of software, and it's free in multiple ways. It's free as in free speech, and it's free as in free beer. It is open source, so you've got a huge, huge community of people working on it and learning about it and discussing it and talking about ways to make it better. And that's what WordCamp is all about, and it's why WordPress is such a great product, quite frankly, because you've got this hive mind working on improving it constantly. It was great when it first started, because I used it in its first release, but it's just gotten better and better. Now, I will be speaking at WordCamp Rhode Island this year. My topic is called Beyond the Blog, and what I'm trying to convey in this talk, and it's going to be a 40-minute talk, is that WordPress is not just a blogging platform. It started as a blogging platform, and it's still widely thought of as a blogging platform. And frankly, Automattic, the people who make WordPress, would probably not object to you calling it a blogging platform, but it's so much more than that. But because of those roots, a lot of larger media organizations are skeptical of it. A lot of use it. You know, the New York Times uses it, the Boston Globe uses it. But a lot of people will tell you, oh, well, we can't use that for our large-scale news site or information site. It's a blogging platform. I disagree with that. Now, WordPress is not right for everybody. Nothing is right for everybody. You have to evaluate everything on a case-by-case basis. But WordPress is, I think, right for most people. So what I'm going to be talking about is how to make that case. And then, once you have made that case successfully, how to set it up to be the enterprise-grade CMS of your dreams that can do everything you want and make your wishes come true. It's a 40-minute talk, and I really encourage you, if you're in the area, to join me. You may have a little farther to travel than I do. I have a 5-minute trip. But if you want to go, it's $40, which is an incredible, incredible deal and a reflection of what the WordPress community is all about. And by the way, I'm not being paid to say this or anything. I tell you this on the New England Tech Podcast because I really, really believe in it. I believe in WordPress. I believe in this event. I don't get any money. I just get you to watch me if you come. But $40 is amazing. Conferences like this that are two full days of solid talks and panel discussions and activities. You get lunch. You get admission to an after party. It's incredible. And the reason it's so cheap is because the WordPress community really wants it to be accessible. That's their philosophy, and that's what you'll get when you attend. Just to give you an idea of what $40 pays for, I went to WordCamp Boston last month, and I got a $50 online course for free. So there, it paid for itself. I got $50 worth of t-shirts probably, or $40 worth of t-shirts at least. So if you're in the area, I encourage you, if you have any sort of interest at all in WordCamp, you don't have to be a developer, you don't have to be an expert, you don't even have to be a WordPress user, you just have to be curious, show up. And if you come, be sure to find me and say hi. I'd love to meet you. Does anybody really know what time it is? Does anybody really care? Well, I know what time it is, and I care. It's time for the news. First up this week, white supremacists. Now, don't worry, I'm not going where you think I am about white supremacists. They've been in the news a lot lately, probably more than they deserve. But I've got a different spin on white supremacists. This week, a new study by UCLA sociologist Aaron Panofsky and Joan Donovan has revealed that many white supremacists take genetic tests via services such as 23andMe and Ancestry.com and find out they're not as white as they think they are. Now, the study didn't talk about why they're taking these tests in the first place, but one can imagine. One can imagine that it's to prove their racial purity. They think, well, I'm white. White people are superior. I need to prove that I'm as white as I say I am, so I'm going to take this test, and I will have solid evidence. I will have scientific evidence. Everybody will know just how white I am. Well, surprise, most of them are not entirely white at all. It turns out that the average person who takes an Ancestry.com test finds that they have a genetic background from five different regions, and the white supremacists are no different. They're finding that too. The study in particular looked at a really fascinating phenomenon, which really is science as well. It's science, it's psychology. When they find out that, oops, I'm not all white, they move the goalpost a little bit, or they make excuses. What they do is they say, well, these are liberal organizations that are intentionally diluting the genetic results to prove to everyone that there are no pure white people. That's something that they actually say on white supremacist online forums, the study found. They also claim that, well, it's not the genetics that matter. It's what you look like in the mirror, which is a really fascinating argument that's kind of tied up very much in the history of race and ethnicity in America. But we don't have time to go into all that during our news segment. It's a fascinating thing to me. You know, Ancestry.com and 23andMe are relatively new services. They came out of the mapping of the human genome. And just the idea that you can know so much more about yourself, about what makes you, than you ever could before, that you can go back hundreds of years and thousands of years and find out your ancestry, is both a great thing and in some ways a creepy thing. And I think the way the white supremacists were intending to use it show that the implications are not all great. But in another sense, maybe it is great because it really shows you the richness of the genetic tapestry out there, if I may use such a flowery phrase. Now, I find the argument about the genetic results being intentionally diluted to be really fascinating, because Ancestry.com is a Mormon-owned company, and certainly the Church of the Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is not known for being a liberal organization. They're, in fact, an organization, they're a religious organization that was officially, and I don't want to offend anyone here, but this is true, until the 1970s, officially white supremacists themselves. So to say that they've got an agenda is just about as illogical as, well, most of the other things that white supremacists will tell you. Next up, we've done a fair amount of discussion on this podcast of the New England tech scene and the Rhode Island tech scene in particular, and what's happening with it, how it's booming. Later on in the show, we'll have an interview with Ray Bugayong, who used to work at HubSpot, a really major tech company in Boston. And we're going to be getting a little bit into how the scene in Boston has improved lately. But one interesting thing that has happened lately in Rhode Island that you may not immediately see as an indicator of the success of the tech scene, but I think if you look a little deeper, you'll find it is the launch of a brand new news source. It's called Rhode Island Inno. Now, Boston has an Inno as well, Bostino. It's part of a national network of news sites dedicated to innovation and technology. And the fact that there's a new tech news source just for Rhode Island, and I'm not just talking about my podcast, I'm talking about this website, really shows how there's a lot of energy and a lot of excitement about covering established companies that are here, covering the startup scene here. But there aren't 75 editions of Inno, right? There's the Boston one, and now there's the Rhode Island one. But here's what they have. They've got Austin, they've got Boston, they've got Chicago, they've got DC, they've got the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and now they've got Rhode Island. And that's incredible, right? Isn't that amazing? Those are the biggest names in technology, or some of the biggest names, at least. Obviously, there's no New York there. There's no San Francisco. But those are all major tech centers and centers of innovation. And the fact that the publishers and the publisher, the name of the publishing company is called American Inno. The fact that these publishers have chosen Little Rhode Island, Little Rhodey, as the next location to join all those really well-known and well-respected places is, I would say, proof that not only is this tech scene up and coming, but it's arrived, because you wouldn't see this if it hadn't arrived. So check it out. It's at AmericanInno.com/Rhode Island, or you can just go to AmericanInno.com and choose Rhode Island from their menu of locations. But take a look. I've been there every day, and I'm as excited about the future of technology in New England and in Rhode Island as they are.
Promise that you like me, 'cause you could go downhill. I can't promise that you love me.
Just now we heard about Rhode Island Inno, the new news source devoted to innovation. So let's talk a little more about innovation. Now, the word innovation is synonymous with technology to a lot of people. So who are the most innovative tech companies out there? If you ask anyone, either within the industry or just off the street, what the most innovative tech companies are, many of them will probably tell you the same thing. They'll tell you Apple, they'll tell you Amazon, Google, Facebook. But when are these companies from? When did they emerge? Most of these companies are ancient by digital standards. The newest one, Facebook, was founded in 2004. That's 13 years ago. 13 years. That is a long time in internet time. So where are the new companies, right? No huge tech company has emerged to dominate its field. Obviously, there's been a lot of innovation. There have been a lot of different companies that have started up. A lot of them have been very successful. But Facebook has billions of users every day. Where's the new company with billions of users? Why hasn't this happened? You know, when Facebook first emerged, I remember that it replaced MySpace, which had replaced Friendster, right? So you had Friendster. And by the way, this is the second podcast in which I've mentioned Friendster, which must be a record for podcasts. Maybe others have mentioned them once. I have mentioned them twice. So I'm sure that that's good for something. But Friendster was really the first modern social network to come out. Then it was complete. It was a huge phenomenon. It never went completely mainstream, but it was on the verge of becoming mainstream when it was supplanted by MySpace. And MySpace became super, super mainstream. I think it's hard to express today, a little bit hard to remember how huge MySpace was, because MySpace, like AOL, became a bit of a joke. But don't get me wrong, MySpace was enormous. It was bought by News Corp, a company that I worked for at the time, for $1 billion, which was considered just crazy at the time. Seems like a small amount now, but at the time everyone was like $1 billion from MySpace. That's nuts. But then it went away. It was supplanted by Facebook. And that used to be the pattern, right? Somebody would innovate, then someone would come up with something better that was more innovative, then someone would come up with something that was more innovative than that, and so on and so forth. But nothing like that has happened since Facebook. Facebook froze it in time. And the same is true for Google and search. The same is true for Amazon and e-commerce and everything else that Amazon is doing, brick and mortar commerce, you name it. What's happened? Why is the innovation just not happening anymore? Well, it may very well be because the tech world has reached maturity. You know, there were times when similar disruptions, to use a word that's very popular in this industry, were occurring in other industries as well. But the internet is still a relatively new thing in time. I always remember a Newsweek magazine cover in 1995 that declared it the year of the internet. 1995, that was the first year that most people in America had heard of the internet. It's not that long ago. That's 22 years ago. That's, you know, in internet time, it's forever. But in the scheme of things, that's not much. So it looks like we've reached maturity and that we have companies now that are big enough to keep out the competition. And the ambition of a lot of these new tech companies is not necessarily to be the Facebook anymore. It's to be sold to the Facebook. This is something that even Facebook dealt with back when they first started. They were late enough to the game that there was a ton of talk about, oh, who's going to acquire Facebook? It actually recently came out, I think last year, that Steve Ballmer, the former CEO of Microsoft and a long, long time Microsoft employee, offered $24 billion to buy Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook, said no, which I think a lot of people probably thought was, again, crazy. Turned out not to be so crazy after all. Zuckerberg wanted to create his own empire. So he turned down the $24 billion, and he turned down a lot of similar offers from other large companies. And he has no regrets now, obviously, but the Zuckerbergs aren't there anymore. Now, is that because Mark Zuckerberg was sort of a singularity? Was he just this person who was headstrong enough, just happened to be there in the right place at the right time? Well, maybe there's an element of that. After all, he's probably running for president. But I think a lot of it has to do with the landscape. Even though you had these companies that were very established back then, they weren't necessarily as established. They weren't necessarily as dominant as your Facebooks or your Amazons are today. So this may have been a natural evolution that always takes place in business. But at the same time, it is unfortunate. I think it's unfortunate. A lot of people think it's unfortunate because you need that turnover. It's part of what tech is all about. You know, tech isn't about being stagnant. It's about always getting new things done in there. And companies like Google and Amazon, they're innovating tremendously from within. They're doing some great, great stuff all the time. These are all companies that I respect and admire tremendously. But who's to say that we're not being deprived of a new company, a new up-and-coming organization that couldn't be even more innovative? But they're not having that opportunity to be as innovative as they could be, because what they're focused on is being innovative for a short period of time and then getting sold to Facebook or getting sold to Google. I wish that more of them would be like Mark Zuckerberg was back then and stick it out. But I can't blame them, because they may have a feeling that they can't compete. Unfortunately, innovation is what gets hurt. And that's our catchphrase for today. It's our buzzword. It's innovation. So innovation will continue to happen. Don't get me wrong. It'll continue to happen. But has it slowed down a little bit? Yeah, maybe it slowed down a little bit. And that's too bad. I think we really need people who are entrepreneurial enough out there to value innovation over a quick buck or a quick billion bucks. And that is very tough. That's a very tough thing to make happen. But I'm not alone in hoping that ultimately it does happen, and we'll all be the better for it when it does. All right, our guest on the podcast this week is Ray Bugayong. I got that right, right?
Yep.
Formerly of HubSpot, now all over the place. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true. I left HubSpot a couple of weeks ago, and I'm actually trying to sort of strike out on my own, doing some strategic consulting with small businesses and some startups here.
That's great. Well, I would love the opportunity to talk more about that in a little while. You are also, and this is very significant, the Boston Banana Man, as I understand.
Yes, that's correct.
Now, the banana bread business is somewhat dormant right now, right?
It is right now. I have to actually dissolve the LLC still, but if at any point I ever wanted to sort of start up a business again, I certainly could. Uh-huh. But I was using the HubSpot software for the last 2 years, actually running my business, and I mainly did a lot of offline events and some digital marketing, which I'm sure we can get to later.
So we'll get more into that, but first, I want to hear about what you were doing as a full-time HubSpot employee.
Yeah, absolutely. Should I take you through like the history, as I actually changed roles from my initial hire?
I would love to hear, the whole story of your time at HubSpot.
Yeah, absolutely. So I joined HubSpot in April of 2014, actually after we had parted ways from Channel One News. And what I had done is I started off as a support engineer in their customer support department. So from there, we essentially were troubleshooting the software, marketing and sales. But I was working as a customer support engineer, and at the time, HubSpot only had a marketing system. But now it actually has a CRM. It has a lot of really great add-ons. And so we were helping customers basically navigate through the platform, troubleshoot any of the issues that they were working with. And as I sort of evolved my skill set, I wanted to go into more of a consulting and a strategic role. So actually towards the end of my 1 year at HubSpot, I started using a little bit of my inbound knowledge and strategy to help customers basically instead of answer, oh, well, now it works, but like, why are you doing it this way? Or, hey, this might be a better solution to what you're trying to accomplish. That eventually led me to become one of the implementation specialists. And what I did there was we worked with customers on a 90-day basis, helping them use the platform. And so this was at the point where HubSpot developed its own CRM, so now we have the marketing platform, the CRM platform, and then all of its other add-ons that it has. And we taught them how to use the platform. We sometimes may have moved a lot of their marketing assets from some of HubSpot's competitors. And we would also try to imbue some of the inbound marketing best practices into their team, essentially. And so there were customers who came in with varying levels of experience, for inbound marketing, some experts, some novices. It was basically up to us to try to work with some of their business goals or their marketing or sales goals and try to help enable success, through use of the platform.
So I want to take a little step back for some listeners who may not be as familiar with the concept of inbound marketing. How would you describe inbound marketing?
So I tend to describe inbound marketing as like a magnet, in the sense that a magnet tends to attract things to it. And that's essentially what inbound marketing is trying to do. For the folks who may not be super familiar with it, I'm sure you may, you're familiar with terms like lead generation or organic traffic, for example. These are the types to think about with inbound marketing, because what you're trying to do is you're trying to attract people to your website, and ideally your ideal customer, because not everybody in the world is going to want to buy a product or service that you want. So you have to, in essence, custom tailor your website and your content, such as blog posts or newsletter emails, to these personas, as they say, your ideal customer. So essentially with inbound marketing, you're trying to build these marketing assets, this content, in order to help people and have them come to your website in order to see some value through that, and then eventually, become a customer of yours through purchasing your products or services.
So I've actually heard lately that HubSpot may have even invented the term inbound marketing. Somebody mentioned that to me recently. I'm wondering, is that true? Did HubSpot actually invent the whole discipline of inbound marketing, as far as you know?
As far as I know, I wouldn't credit inbound marketing 100% to HubSpot, especially as far as inventing it. And I was actually thinking about this. We had a colleague at Channel One News, AJ. Do you remember her?
I do. Yes. By the way, just for the listeners, Ray and I used to work together at Channel One News, something like 5 years ago, right? I was there from 2008 to 2013. You left, I think, you mentioned 2014.
Yeah, I was there from 2013 to 2014, so just a small contract.
All right, so you're saying?
Yeah, so AJ, she reminds me a lot of inbound marketing, because I was starting a concept for my banana bread business, and she mentioned, hey, once you become the expert, people are naturally going to flock to you. And once I joined HubSpot, one of the co-founders, Dharmesh, he was actually giving a keynote at Inbound, I believe, a year ago, talking about how he actually started blogging, a lot of really valuable information on his personal website even before HubSpot got started. And he started to see a very big increase in traffic over the next couple of months. And it wasn't something in particular, it was something that he was very, very passionate about, but he didn't realize that a lot of people were sort of seeking out these answers to the questions that they were asking. So Dharmesh is, he's one of the CTOs. And I think HubSpot does a very good job of sort of marketing the concept of inbound marketing, especially as a marketing company. I don't think they necessarily invented it. I think the concept has been around for a long while. We just needed to put a name to it.
Yeah. So HubSpot, they took something that kind of existed already, improved upon it, named it, right? So probably the name inbound marketing originated from HubSpot. You were an insider there for years. Mm-hmm. You saw the inner workings. You saw the management. You saw what goes on a day-to-day basis. Why did HubSpot succeed in doing that where others have not succeeded? And I would also ask you at the same time, HubSpot is maybe, I would say, even the signature company of the Boston tech scene. What is it was able to achieve that level of success?
That's a good question. I don't know particularly what's going on around at a lot of the other companies who are HubSpot's competitors. I can definitely say that internally, the management team was very, very sort of receptive, to a lot of ideas. Because when I had joined HubSpot in 2014, there wasn't a whole lot of processes which were sort of set in stone, so to speak. Not like it is today. So there was a lot of room for improvement, a lot of room for, suggestions, from a lot of the other employees. And I think that's what really helped sort of drive HubSpot's success. Alongside that, we have a very, very good customer support team that manages a lot of customers worldwide now that HubSpot is international. And I think the support team and actually the rest of services does an extremely great job, of retaining its customers, of actually caring for one, and really trying to help, the HubSpot customers succeed. So I think it's really a combination of, leadership and management sort of taking these ideas and, trying to implement them obviously where it makes sense. Our customer services team and also, HubSpot as a marketing company, I think makes a lot of noise, which is great. Mm-hmm. I think they put themselves out there really well enough so much that, we can consider HubSpot as like the inbound marketing customers.
Yeah, and it's a very digital story, isn't it? In that it's not top-down. You don't have these people giving you marching orders. Everybody, and you're a great example of that, because you started in kind of, you know, what might be considered a less important role, and you were still able to contribute and still able to get to the point that you wanted to be at in your career.
Yeah, no, I agree with that, and that's exactly, you know, what happened. There's a lot of flexibility in terms of moving, you know, cross-departmentally or even into different disciplines if you wanted in the early days. It's kind of stalled now. But there was a lot of room, you know, for its employees to really work autonomously. And just like you said, like, it wasn't very top-down. It was very, you know, horizontal. Like, things were laid out. You know, there were goals. How do you get there? You can choose how you want to get there as long as it, you know, satisfies them.
So I think for a lot of people, particularly in the New England scene, the Boston scene, HubSpot was kind of synonymous with startup. It was kind of the startup. But what happens with startups is they stop being startups. And I think you touched a little bit on changes that happen within the company when that sort of thing happens. Did you see that transition happening from we're a startup to, well, now we're a larger, more established company? And what changed?
I did. I won't go into it too much, but that was part of the reason why I had left HubSpot.
Stay within the legal boundaries, please.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So what I had felt had really changed with HubSpot, I mean, they still, like, really tout their startup culture. I mean, there's free beer, there's a lot of food, there's some really great benefits, you know, that the company has, which I think still categorizes it as a startup. But how big its business is, how big the company is, and sort of the number of locations, I think that falls outside of a startup. I would really consider HubSpot a corporation that has a startup-like culture. Uh-huh. That being said, I feel like the culture itself has really remained sort of top of its game. You know, a lot of employees who are still there are still very happy. They find really great satisfaction in their job. And for some of the roles, which may be new, there's sort of an ability for them to shape it, you know, in their sort of in their image. Now, where I feel that HubSpot has really sort of gained its corporatization has been, at least for me, sort of the level of flexibility in terms of our promotions. So it's tough for, I think that it's tough for a company to, you know, encourage its employees to say, hey, you know, you can still grow this skill set, you can get promoted if you do X, Y, and Z. But, you know, there are only so many positions that a company can open, there are only so many people that they can hire, and not that HubSpot was promising anything, but there's a lot of hype, you know, for sort of moving around in the company, where it was really prominent a couple of years ago, where people would move and there would be this really great jubilation and other folks would look at that and say, hey, like, you know, we can do this too. But one of the reasons why I left was that I felt I actually couldn't grow at HubSpot. And to some degree, I know that sounds like really egotistical, like, oh, right, you, like, maxed out all your skills. It's not necessarily true. There were a couple of positions that I wanted to go for. I didn't get it, felt like I could use my skill set somewhere else. And personally, I like working with small businesses and startups a whole lot more just because of that flexibility. So sort of coming for me, I felt like the way that you can progress in the company is one of the ways that, you know, HubSpot is really corporatized. I mean, there are some other ones as well, but, you know, to stay within sort of the good standing here. I think that was just one of the biggest things.
No, I got it. So that startup culture that you were talking about, you know, you mentioned free beer. But it goes beyond free beer, doesn't it? The startups are associated with the stuff, the beer, the ping pong tables, et cetera, et cetera, the T-shirts that, that you pose for photos in. But what defines HubSpot's culture beyond the stuff? Obviously, the collaborativeness, or not necessarily the collaborativeness, but the sense that anyone can contribute is changing. But what's consistent? What makes HubSpot beyond the material things?
I think that HubSpot continues to do an extremely great job of hiring great individuals. And I think that sort of like the level of quality of their new hires is what has really kept the culture going. Because any individual at HubSpot is going to be an expert at something, whether it's something that you're proficient in, whether it's something that you've never even heard of. And a lot of folks at HubSpot are very, very open and willing to talk about these disciplines in order to help other people grow. I think that that's a very, very good, you know, sort of way to encourage your employees to, you know, cross-pollinate between departments just to get a better understanding of the product, about their discipline, about your discipline. And it also leads to some sort of like really interesting conversations or sort of activities out of work. Like if you have a bunch of people that like to go rock climbing or like to go hiking, you can usually find a group of people at HubSpot who are willing to do that. And it just builds more sort of like a bigger community outside of the office. And one of the things to sort of tack onto that is that I, at a lot of my jobs previously, I never really felt like I could have hung out, you know, with a lot of my colleagues after work. But at HubSpot, these are the same people that I see day in, day out, but I hang out with them on the weekends. I go out to drinks with them after work. And maybe it was just me, but HubSpot seems to encourage that type of interaction, you know, between its employees in order to foster a better environment.
Yeah, I think a good indication of what the culture of a company is like is how many of your coworkers or your Facebook friends, right? I've worked for companies where I've got tons of Facebook friends, and then I've worked for companies where I don't really have any, or, you know, one or two. So I would rather personally work for the company where people end up your Facebook friends.
Oh, yeah. And that was actually one of the biggest things that, you know, kept me going into the office. I mean, HubSpot has a policy where you can remote, you know, if you really need to, like you're traveling or you're sick or anything like that. But I'd say that 90% of employees who are actually able to make it into the office actually go there. And being with those people physically and being able to interact with them is one of the biggest reasons why they do that. So.
That's great. That's great. So you moved to Boston to work for HubSpot. Is that correct? We obviously worked together in New York before that.
Yep.
That's correct. As someone who was more of an outsider and then jumped into really headfirst this Boston tech scene, because not only did you just go to work for a company in Boston, but you went to work for, in what some senses, is the tech company in Boston. What was your a take on the local tech scene in Boston when you landed there?
Yeah. So just as a bit more history, I was actually in Boston before New York. So from 2010 to 2012, I was in Boston. 2013, I was in New York, and then I came back to Boston in 2014.
Well, I'd love to know even what may have changed in that time.
Yeah. Before, when I was in Boston, I wasn't too ingrained in the tech scene. I think it was more the entertainment and like indie game development, which I guess is a little bit techy. and I was doing a lot of digital art and some content creation as a freelancer. And so what I had seen during that time, again, like back in 2012, was that there wasn't a really big tech scene, honestly. I mean, I'm seeing downtown Cambridge, I'm seeing like downtown Boston. There are a lot of, you know, companies that are moving here. There are a lot of companies that are, you know, erecting their buildings, putting in their office spaces. A lot of that didn't really seem to exist about 5 years ago. And I think that coming back to Boston in 2014, you know, I started to see a lot of that really gain some traction. There are a lot of companies who used to be in the building that HubSpot is in. They moved on to bigger and better things, like closer to downtown, which is really great. There are more startups that are here. I can definitely say that while it's not tech, there are more food trucks, which I think may have helped contribute to this.
Yes, it's an indicator.
Yeah. So there wasn't a food truck scene. There wasn't a huge tech scene. And I think that a lot of people are really seeing Boston as, you know, sort of like a Silicon Valley on the East Coast, so to speak. So I think that that did have a bit of a catalyst to it, but
yeah,
it used to exist.
It really, you're absolutely right about that. It really is incredible. I remember looking for jobs in Boston around that same time, right, when you were first in the city, and not really being able to find very much that interested me. I love Boston, and I was interested in the idea of living there, and I was looking for jobs, and I thought, well, this is really disappointing because there's not much here that I want to do. And that has changed tremendously. There's just a ton of stuff going on, a ton of action, and a ton of food trucks.
Yeah, definitely.
So we talked about you as a HubSpotter. That's what they call you, right? HubSpotters?
Yep, that's correct.
So we talked about you as a HubSpotter. I want to hear more about you as a HubSpot user. Mm-hmm. So you had a banana bread business, Bye Bye Banana Bread. Which is now dormant, but you know, hopefully we'll start up again because everyone needs good banana bread in many, many flavors. How many flavors did you have?
I had 6 flavors. In addition to the original, I had strawberry, blueberry, chocolate chip, peanut butter, and Nutella.
Ah, well, that sounds very good, but you'll have to send me some. But how did HubSpot help your business?
So when I arrived at HubSpot, so I started the business officially in 2015, so this is a year after I had started. What I had done was I knew that I wanted to start the business, but I also knew that I had to learn how to market it properly. So during our training, when I got hired at HubSpot, they taught us the inbound marketing methodology. They taught us a lot about its concepts and a lot about how, you know, a lot of our customers would be using it. It was very fortuitous because HubSpot gives each of its employees a HubSpot portal, which is essentially the software that all of the customers use, and they give it to us for full access. And even after we leave the company, which is great, I still have access to it now.
That's actually really nice. Reminds me of when after I worked for Channel One, I still had access to all the stuff afterwards, but that's just because they forgot to turn off my account.
Oh, I see. Yeah, HubSpot will allow its employees to keep the software to use for their own personal projects under the condition that you don't try to directly compete with HubSpot, which I think is a fool's errand anyway. But while I was working as a support engineer, I started tooling around inside of the software, A, not only to get a better understanding and more intimate look at it, but B, also to use it for my business. So as odd as it may sound, I was one of the few people at HubSpot who was actively using our HubSpot portal for other projects. So what I decided to do was I had learned about the concept of search engine optimization, and that allowed me to basically blog for an entire year before I actually built up the website and made it live. It worked really, really well, so I was able to capture a lot of really good search queries, and in Boston, there's not a whole lot of banana bread that's sold here, so it's a really great capture for me. And I worked very intimately with the system. The marketing side of the platform allows you to build a website so you can host your domain and host all of your marketing assets. We have landing pages and forms, which allow you to capture information, and then, of course, an email tool, which allows you to communicate with them. There's social media, there's web analytics, there's list segmentation, and now they also have a CRM, which is meant more for sales, such as opening deals, working with correspondents, and also just trying to track the engagement of these folks to see if any of your marketing is actually working. So as a user, it was actually a lot easier for me to empathize with a lot of my customers who I worked with as a support engineer and as an implementation specialist, because everything that they would run into, any roadblocks that they would look at, I would have sort of the same grievances. But I was lucky enough to speak with our product experts and just understand, hey, why isn't this working? Oh, it's because of X, Y, and Z.
Dog fooding is what you were doing.
Yeah, in a sense. And that allowed me to build just like better rapport with a lot of my customers. But I used the system day in and day out. Essentially what I used HubSpot for was I had the website. I had an e-commerce store that was connected to it, which was Squarespace actually. And I used the website mainly as a point of – or as like a home base, because I mentioned earlier that I went to a lot of farmers markets. And so I always told people, hey, you know, check out our website, interact with us on Facebook. And that's what got people, you know, on the website and sort of talking about the business. So I didn't exactly follow the inbound marketing methodology. One thing that they say is that when you build content, you should exchange content with somebody with their information. So if I wanted to download an ebook, for example, on how to become like a freelance consultant, I would have to give somebody my email address in exchange for receiving that ebook. That's how it typically works. I did a little bit of that before. I had created some recipes that all had to do with bananas, set up a landing page with a form, and hope that people would come by on the website, download it, and in receiving their email, I can communicate with them and try to get them to become a customer by buying on the store. A couple of months after I had done that, promoting all of these marketing assets, I didn't really see, a lot of people come to the website and download it. And I had realized that even something that I do, I just go to food.com and I take a look at a recipe, which is already laid out. You don't need to download anything. You don't need to submit your email or any info. And I thought to myself, if I just give these people the recipe, then maybe that'll just work out better and people will talk about it and share and all that kind of stuff. And it worked out a little bit. After I released all of the recipes, some people came by to the website and they gave some comments. But I felt that, at least for my business, offline marketing worked much, much better rather than the online. And so it just sort of had its place there. And social media was really, really great. Facebook and Instagram actually worked out really, really well. But one of the reasons why I think the offline marketing tended to have worked so well is because I actually wore a banana suit you know, at farmers markets, and that I would consider inbound marketing in real life, because again, as a magnet, people were really curious about the banana suit, and that's how I drove more sales.
I'm really glad you brought up the banana suit, because I thought we were not going to have time to go into that. And I also know that you were actually on HubSpot's corporate website at one point wearing the banana suit, because I witnessed this myself.
Yes. Actually, if you go to the HubSpot jobs page, which might be www.hubspot.com/jobs, they have, they're always looking for employees with heart. I was the H, which H stands for humble. I don't know if I'm humble saying it. I actually forget what E-A-R-T means, but I was one of the members that they did a photo shoot and said, hey, if you want to be on the website, we'd love to have you in the banana suit. I said, why not?
Yeah, you know, in old Hollywood, they used to hire people to play gorillas who owned their own gorilla suits. They were called gorilla men. So you're kind of the banana suit man.
Yeah.
So we're almost out of time, but I didn't want to part without asking you this one question, which is not about tech at all. So I'm going to spring this on you.
Okay.
My secret shame, a lot of people know, and I'm revealing it to everybody here in the podcast, is that I am a longtime fan of professional wrestling.
Oh.
And a great wrestling-related story I heard once from someone who went backstage at a now WWE, it was then the WWF, one of their live events back in the 80s, when Hulk Hogan was a huge star. And he goes backstage, he meets Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan is sitting there eating a Snickers bar. And the guy says to Hulk Hogan, well, it's great to meet you, but I'm surprised to see you eating that Snickers bar. I thought you were all about training and taking your vitamins and working out. Yep. And Hulk Hogan looks at him and says, brother, I work out so I can eat this Snickers bar. Now, as someone who I happen to know is very much into fitness and is also very much into banana bread, I'm wondering if you share that philosophy.
I actually do, yes. It's really funny because I did go to the gym today. It was leg day. And I actually stopped by a donut shop and got a donut breakfast sandwich, which was loaded with protein. Luckily, the donut wasn't decorated with too much sugar. But I thought to myself, like today's a cheat day and I've definitely earned it. So I do definitely share that philosophy. I work out to try to eat as much as I possibly can. And just to, you know, try to stay healthy overall.
All right. Ray Bugayong, thanks a lot for being with us on the podcast today.
Thank you, Stephen, for having me. I've had a very good chat.
The podcast today, I talked about the discussion that I'm going to be having with the attendees of WordCamp Rhode Island 2017 next month about WordPress and how you can sell WordPress to skeptical media organizations. Next week, I am going to be talking a little more about that presentation that I'm going to be giving, because I believe so much in WordPress. And I believe in its power. There are skeptics out there. There have always been skeptics since day one of WordPress. But I honestly believe that for most organizations, not all organizations, because of course nothing is true for all organizations, but for most organizations, WordPress really is the way to go. And we'll hear a lot more about why on the podcast Tuesday next week. Thanks a lot for listening, everybody. I hope you had fun today. As you do every week, I personally have a lot of fun doing this show. Just speaking from the heart to you, this is sincere. I'm not being an FM DJ with false effusiveness. I'm not being a game show host. I really have fun doing this show, and I want you guys to have fun listening. So please be here every Tuesday for more news, more interviews, more commentary. I'll be here. Hope you are too.